one of the reasons that I love Sophia, and everybody likes Sophia Kennedy, and I can just go down through the list, is it's not just because of their resiliency, it's because of their dreams.
Welcome to Waiting is the Hardest. The focus of this podcast is sharing stories of people overcoming difficult situations in life. Our goal is to inform and educate you through stories of hope, healing, and perseverance. Hit stop now if you're sensitive to mature subjects, because this story is raw, real, and unfiltered. Double bonus, an interview with pediatric bone marrow specialist, Dr. Greg Yannick.
Hi, I'm Lisa.
And I'm Janita. Welcome to Waiting is the Hardest. For the listeners and the viewers, I want to introduce Dr. Gregory Yannick. He is the clinical director of the pediatric, now tell me if I get this wrong, Dr. Yannick, the clinical director of the pediatric blood and bone marrow transplant at the University of Michigan Medical Center, Mott Children's Hospital. Did I say that?
Sounds perfect.
Oh, okay. Whew. That was tough. I was scared. Okay. I just learned that Dr. Yannick, just like with our other doctor that we interviewed, Dr. Campbell, he too is a pediatric hematologist oncologist. He was explaining to me that, you know, as doctors are going through their residency or going through their training, they choose a niche, and his niche is bone marrow, and Dr. Campbell's was sickle cell. So I learned something new today. But Dr. Yannick, thank you for being here this afternoon. I'm so pleased to see you and to have you on the With podcast.
I am so excited to be here as well. I just look forward to talking to you, to talking to you and your family, the journey that you've been through, and to everybody who's listening.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, I want to start off by, so I shared as a backstory for everybody who's listening and watching, I shared with Dr. Yannick the purpose of the podcast, much like I shared with you all who are listening and watching. And so, you know, as part of that, we want to wrap up season two by bringing in Dr. Yannick's perspective as an expert in bone marrow and the bone marrow transplant process. Dr. Yannick was Sophia and Kennedy's doctor. And I just want to say right off the bat that when you walked into our patient room, there, like when you first uttered your first words, I knew that there was something different about you. And that's no knack to any of our other providers. They were all quite wonderful for the most part. But there was something different about how you just interact with the patients and the families. There was just this gentleness, this warmness, this kindness. And I want to start, it was just so remarkable. It was so comforting during a time of chaos, dare I say. And I just want to know, first off, did you learn that? Did you always have that? Like, where does that come from? We need to know, because we need to replicate it.
Yeah. Oh, good heavens.
I'm sorry. I'm starting off like with a loaded question, because that,
You know, my mother and father, it's those around you that become your role models and mentors. My own training, when I trained to be a pediatric hematologist oncologist, there was a gentleman named Dr. Charles Main that I just worshipped in terms of how he worked with families. And I said, you know what, I got to model how I interact with families, how he does. But the other thing that was happening at the same time, Janita, is that over time, I realized that I've got the best job in the world. Okay. And because I'm actually, every day I walk in excited because I realize that I've got a rare opportunity to help patients, to help families with the thing that they hold the dearest to them. And that's the life of their son or their daughter. And for me, it's an honor. So when I walk in to meet you, to meet Sophia, to meet Antoine, I walk in already honored and grateful to meet you. Okay. Just because I just smile thinking about the trust and faith that you have, that you place in the medical team, and how grateful we are to be part of that. You know, when about two years to be exact, there was a mother whose son had been battling leukemia for several years. And at one point during the journey, I asked her, her first name was Tracy, and I said, "Tracy, if there's one thing you could tell our medical team, what you've learned over this whole process." And she said, she looked up at me and she goes, "Dr. Yannick, it's a gratitude circle." And I looked at her and I said, "All right, that's a different term, a gratitude circle." And I said, "Tracy, tell me what you're thinking." She goes, "Dr. Yannick, yes, we are so thankful for your medical team, for your staff, for the nurses, for the physicians, for everybody. But you have to realize it's a circle. We want your gratitude back. We want to know that you are truly grateful to be able to take care of our son and daughter, and that you feel blessed in being able to do so. So, Dr. Yannick, when we're looking for physicians, we're looking for people who complete the circle."
Wow.
And that's the attitude I hope to take every single day, Janita, in my practice and when I wake up and start taking care of children on our oncology floor. It's a gratitude circle, because I actually feel this, that we're all part of a puzzle. And it's a big puzzle with a lot of pieces. And the patient is the center of that puzzle. She's the main piece. But yourself as Sophia's mother, Antoine as her father, your family, because there's so many family members that have to be involved. You know, they always say it takes a village. But yes, all the family members are part of this puzzle. The nurses, myself, if I'm involved in the care, our nurse practitioners, our other faculty around us, the social workers, the pharmacists, even the environmental service persons that help to clean our room,
sure,
because we need clean rooms. And literally it goes down to every single piece of that puzzle. And not one piece is more important than the other piece. And if you go into that care, thinking that you're pulling together a puzzle, to build a puzzle so that you can see the entire picture of that patient, then I feel that as a physician, you've got the right model in your mind. Each piece stands on its own, but each piece is interconnected to each other, and each piece collectively builds that patient's care.
Wow. Wow. And that is the reason why you are in high demand. That is the exact reason why. And Dr. Yannick, I'm also curious to know, you talked about trust, patient trust, family trust, having the pleasure, it's an honor to, work with the families. But not every provider has that kind of mindset. And so I can imagine that when you enter the room, sometimes there are families who have been jaded and they feel distrustful, but you are also able to move them past that. And how do you do that?
Do you know who Pat Riley is? He's the general manager of the Miami Heat,
mm-hmm,
formerly of the Los Angeles Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat Riley had a statement that hit me one time. He actually said this on air, and I sat there and I turned to my wife and said, "I'm writing this down because I'm using this." Here was a statement for, and everybody listening, I think you should own up to this too in your own life. With commitment, you're either in or you're out. There's no in between.
Mm.
My fellowship training director in Cincinnati, where I trained, her name was Bea Lampkin, and she had a great Southern accent. And she told me one time when I was talking to her about something, and she said, "Greg, just remember, if you're going to be there at the beginning, you better darn well be there at the end. Don't leave at halftime. And those two comments together by Pat Riley, you know, with commitment, you're either in or you're out. There's no in between. And don't leave at halftime. That's the mantra that I want every member of our staff to have when they're taking care of individuals like Sophia and Kennedy and everybody, actually.
Yeah.
You know, make a commitment to that care. And I always tell, I always want patients to feel this, Janita and Lisa. When you walk into a room and you meet us, I need you to really feel that we care about the care that we're giving your son or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't feel that, then it's time for a change. And potentially it's a change in how we do things.
Yeah.
So we have to be able to make that commitment to you, to your daughter in this case, to your husband, to your whole family, because we can't leave at halftime and we can't be partially in or out. We have to be fully in. And that's the attitude that I take. Why? Because I think your daughter is a perfect example. She's the reason that I smile and just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
It's that resiliency of the Sophias of the world that's now in graduate school, doing, I think in my mind, on the cusp of greatness. For those of you who are listening, I told Janita that Sophia's got a guaranteed letter of recommendation for me for life.
Yes.
Not because of the journey that she's gone through, but because of the path that she's laying in front of her
right.
in the days ahead. I'm just such a big fan and supporter of her, but not only her, but all of our patients, the young and the old, all of our children, all of our teenagers, all of our young adults that go through this journey and this battle.
Wow. I love that. I love that. You know, Dr. Campbell talked about, I asked him a similar question and he talked about, you know, really when there's situations with families, they're unhappy or they're, you know, conflicts, that he does a lot of reflecting on their concerns, their comments, and validating their issues and not being afraid to apologize, you know, and to own up to, you know, issues if it's on the part of him or someone on his team. And you know, I wanted to get your thoughts on that. And if you've seen that in action, if you've tried that strategy, just get your thoughts.
It's a great question because you're hitting home to me just from 2 days ago. I realized that I didn't give a family due justice on something in terms of what they needed from me in this particular situation. And I called them and apologized.
Yeah.
And as a parent who was listening to this podcast, think about how many times a physician, a nurse practitioner, a nurse has actually called you to apologize.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Because it suddenly hit me. I put myself in their position and I started thinking, if I was in their position and heard ABC, how would I feel? And I was like, you know what? That's not how I want them to feel. So I actually called them and I said, you know, if I could do this again, I would do A, C, B.
Mm-hmm.
I probably thought this through a little more, but you know, we're all human, Janita and Lisa. And, you know, in fact, when I work at Mott Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for those of you that are listening, and we built our new children's hospital in 2012. And they had meetings to have, they invited physicians, nurses, team members, just to give us their thoughts for how to build the perfect children's hospital. What do you want in this children's hospital? And a gal named Gretel Quitmeyer, who was the nurse manager for our oncology floor, was sitting in a meeting with me one time with everybody, and she looked up and she said, "Chairs on the wall."
Chairs on the wall?
And she said, "Chairs on the wall." And everybody kind of looked and stopped and said, what does that mean? And she said, here's what and why, is that when our nursing staff comes in, because she was the nurse manager, when the physicians come in, I don't want them standing talking to the families. I want them actually sitting talking to the families. I don't want them standing over the families talking down to them. I want them sitting alongside the families. In fact, I want the chairs in a part of the room that you have to walk past the bed to get to the chair so that you're not even close to the door if possible. Meaning when we walk into a room that we actually sit mm-hmm. down and listen and sit alongside them, not above them, but alongside them. Because part of the role that we have to embrace as physicians and nurses is that it's not just to take care of the patient.
Yeah.
It's actually educate the patient. In many ways, Janita, it's about 50% of our job is to serve as an educator for the patient, for the parents, for the other caregivers, for everybody. Because you, in essence, as a mom, as a dad coming to us, you become our eyes and our ears to the patient. We're not there 24/7. We may come during rounds at 10 o'clock in the morning, spend 15 minutes in the room. We may come back at 4,
right.
Maybe peek our heads in at 6, whatever. And then when you're out of the hospital, we're not seeing you. The only way that we can get you to be our eyes and our ears
right.
is if we teach you what to look for. You know, so it behooves us to be able to sit down and teach. And a lot of people have told me that, my first name is Greg, for those listening, is that, well, do you do a lot of teaching? And I said, well, I don't do as much teaching to medical students and to physicians as much as I used mm-hmm. to, but I do a lot more teaching to families. And I really feel that that's one of our main roles. And whether you're taking your daughter, son or daughter to see a physician for an earache or a sore throat, whether you're taking your mother in for a blood pressure check or for some issue that may be, let's say, related to their overall care as they get older, it's our job to be able to teach you what to watch for. Okay. So I view that as, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about that puzzle a few minutes ago. But every puzzle has corners to it. And I view education as one of the cornerstones of every puzzle.
Wow. Yeah, okay. No, it makes so much sense. And you mentioned the education piece and it being so critical. So when a family, because the theme of this season is patients with sickle cell who have gone on to receive a bone marrow transplant. So when you have a patient or a family, they've decided to look towards or move towards transplant, what are the types of things that your team does initially to educate parents, to help them to, you know, maybe they haven't made the decision, maybe they're trying to decide. What does that education piece look like initially?
You know, I think each case is different, Janita and Lisa. Each case you have to take on its own merits. And for us, it starts with intake meetings. As we start talking about a patient, I'm just going to make mm-hmm. a fictitious name, Jim Smith. So as we start talking about Jim Smith, those that know Jim Smith will say, all right, tell me what Jim's been through. And we literally have an intake meeting. We actually hold these at our center, and many centers do the same thing. We hold it every Monday morning. Okay. And the meeting can run an hour, can run longer. And we go over all the patients that are prospective patients, and we just talk about them. But the meeting isn't held with myself and one of our coordinators. The meeting is held with every physician present. The meeting is actually held with all of the coordinators there. The meeting is held with all the nurse practitioners there. The meeting is held with lead nurses from the floor, both inpatient and outpatient there. The meeting is held with our physical therapists, with our financial planners, with our social workers, Because mm-hmm. literally it's an entire team. The folks that do the tissue typing, they're all there. Our folks from our cell processing laboratory, from our blood bank, because every one of these pieces is key and is essential into figuring out, all right, what's the right thing to do for Jim Smith? And we literally will go around the room. We may be talking to the person of blood bank. All right, tell me about what issues Jim Smith has. All right, Dr. Yak, we're already running into problems getting blood cross-match for Jim. He has so many antibodies already that we're worried that if we keep transfusing him, we're going to run to the point that we can't even get any red blood cells for Jim. Does that impact your decision to do transplant for Jim? Well, it certainly does. And that's why I need the input from our blood bank, our social work. Well, Dr. Yannick, you know, it's a single mom, and she's got three other kids, and they live 3 hours away. We've got to be cognizant of this. What's their support system? Who can be the backup for that mother? Because what if the mother gets sick? What if one of the other children gets sick?
Right.
Because life happens.
Right.
You know, I'm gonna come back to this whole meeting in a second. But recently I took one of our fellows to lunch, and I said, bring your patient list to me. And I said, all right, who's your first patient? He goes, well, it's a 16-year-old with Hodgkin's disease that we've given three cycles of ABVD to so far, and it looks like they still have disease. I said, well, where do they live? Up north. Well, what's grade is he in? I'm not sure. So I just looked at the fellow. I said, this meeting is over. I said, lunch is done. Finish your lunch. We don't need to talk anymore. I'm taking you to lunch next week again. And I want you to tell me who the patients are on your list. And we're going to start with this one. Well, here's why I'm telling you the story, because the following Friday was a Friday, and this fellow came back and he said, well, Dr. Yank, I think I know what you're talking about. So the first patient on the list is a 16-year-old with Hodgkin's disease. They live, I'm just making this up now, it's a fictitious place, but they live in Standish, Michigan, north of Bay City. The mom is single. There are a couple other kids. The young man, amazingly, was playing JV basketball and still trying to play JV basketball while get chemotherapy.
Wow.
And the mom gave up her job so that she could literally focus on her son's care and making sure that the other three kids get care. She's got one car that is barely, you know, running. And I looked at the fellow. I said, all right, now we're talking.
Because mm-hmm. okay. it's more than just a name on a piece of paper.
Right. A patient with stage 3 Hodgkin's disease who's failed 3 rounds of chemotherapy. No. Yeah. And you asked me, what do we do when we start preparing families? Well, at this intake meeting, that's the level of detail that we go over. All right, okay. Tell me about Jim Smith. What's going on with this? What's going on with this? Who's in part, what's their support system? What do we need to know to help Jim Smith and his family get through it? After we get to that point, and then interestingly enough, Juniata, you're going to raise a few eyebrows when I tell you this. Is that sometimes we'll at the meeting, we'll say, you know what? I don't think Jim needs the transplant. Okay. Oh. It may be that, you know what? Jim's doing fine. His disease is mild. We've done a preliminary search for a donor. We don't have great donor options. I don't think we should be going forward right now.
Yeah.
And then there'll be other times we'll sit there in the meeting and we'll say, all right, boy, Jim definitely needs this transplant. You know, we're running out of the ability to transfuse him. He's already had 3 episodes of chest syndrome, and this is just taking a beating on his lungs and his heart. He's already got a lot of iron overload in his body that's affecting potentially his liver, because we'll go through all the organs. All right, we need to get transplant done for Jim with the best available donor that we can find. Meaning we'll actually have an intake meeting that goes over to that level of detail. Patients and who they are, not just as a child with sickle cell, but who they are as an entire family unit, and what medical issues do we need to think about? Because transplant's not for everybody.
Right.
Okay. You know, I always think of that mantra from the Marines, the few, the proud, the brave.
That applies to transplant.
One of the reasons that I love Sophia, and everybody likes Sophia Kennedy, and I can just go down through the list, is it's not just because of their resiliency, it's because of their dreams. And we always have a saying, Lisa, happy are those who dream dreams and have paid the price to make them come true. And it's truly a saying that I think everybody listening to this podcast should embrace. Again, happy are those that have dreamed dreams and have paid the price to make them come true. Because for patients who go through transplant, the statistics are pretty stark. And I'm not talking about patients who go through transplant for sickle cell right now. I'm just saying patients who go through transplant, especially teenagers and young adults who go through transplant. And here's the statistics. The chances of going to college are much lower than the general population if you've gone through transplant. If you do go to college, the chances of graduating from college are much lower. The chances of finding a job are much lower. The chances of ending up on welfare are much higher. The chances of getting married are lower. And again, this isn't pertaining to any particular disease. It's just patients who get transplant, you know, it's a journey. And it does change you. The transplant itself is not a singular event that happens on March 1st, 2023. It's a lifelong of events that happen, as you have to follow these patients lifelong to make sure that their organs are all working. But you also have to make sure that their psyche is working. Okay. And thus, when I started this little segment, I said, that's why I'm so endeared to individuals like Sophia, individuals like Kennedy, because they have dreams. And you know what? Dang it. They're not going to let transplants stand in the way of their dreams. You know, my daughter ran a collegiate track, and she was just an outstanding hurdler. She ran the 400-meter hurdle, so once around the track. And I asked her one time, I said, what's the hardest part of the race? And she looked up at me and she said, Dad, the toughest part of the race is this. I swear, the longer I run, the more hurdles they keep putting up on the track. I think those judges are actually out there adding more hurdles. You know, like, wait a second, there's supposed to be 10. How come there's 13 out there now? And that's what transplant's like. You know, as you're running around this lap, all of a sudden it's like, oh, where did this hurdle come from? You know, nobody told me about this hurdle, about this hurdle. And how many more hurdles are there? I think one of the most sobering things for parents, for families to hear is this, is going through transplant is like running a marathon. And our job as parents, because I'm a parent myself, I have three children. Our job as parents is to serve as cheerleaders. You know, it's our son, it's our daughter that's running. Our job is to be out there cheering for them. The whole family's job, all the relatives, their friends, their cousins, their aunts, their uncles, their teachers, their support group. One of the most difficult things that happens in this marathon race is that the longer the race goes on, the fewer cheerleaders are out there. I mean, that's a very sobering thought. I've seen it so many times. And this is why I love the Sophias and Kennedys of the world, because they're running no matter how many cheerleaders are out there.
Yeah, they're going to run regardless.
And if you think about it, it's the way life is. You know, I keep using this name, this fictitious name, Jimmy Smith. There really isn't a Jimmy Smith that we transplanted, okay?
Jimmy's like, why am I on a podcast?
Yeah, exactly. If there's a Jimmy Smith listening, this is I'm just making this name up, okay? But, you know, Jimmy Smith starts transplant, and all these people are out there to support Jimmy and to support his parents, to support the other kids. And then as 6 months goes by, as a year goes by, as 3 years goes by, as 5 years goes by, you start finding out who you can really count and depend on, because the cheering section starts dwindling in numbers. And then all of a sudden, you get to be out there 5, 10 years, and you think, you know what? I'm still running, and I need that support.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, when Janita asked me if I could do this, help her with this podcast, I just smiled and I said, dang it, I certainly will. Why? Because I not only have her daughter isn't just somebody who ran around this track and did one lap around this track. Her daughter just kept running.
Yeah.
And continues to run.
And what you said about the, you know, it being a marathon is so true. Sophia is 12 years post-transplant. As of January 7th this year. And yet she shared this on the podcast, she is now entering this phase where she's, you know, grappling with the outcomes of the chemotherapy in regards to her reproductive health. Right? This is a new phase. And so we're having those conversations. I'm supporting her with that, listening to her as she's talking about choices that she wants to make with her life as a result of that. So you are absolutely correct in that it does not, it doesn't end, you know, and you do know, you do find out who's really for you and in your section, because, you know, 12 years later, there's a group of people that Sophia can count on, her Aunt Lisa, myself, Antoine, her, you know, that's, luckily our village is still quite large, but that's not the same, that's not the case for a lot of patients. So that's an excellent point that you bring up.
In fact, for many people, they go through this, not with sickle cell, but with leukemia, with lymphomas, just name the disorder, that go through transplant. It's not even a village. Many people go into it with just a couple houses on the street. Many people go into it with just one house on the street.
Yeah.
You know, the love of a mother, father, and that's it. You know, we have a family that came not too long ago for a consult with me, and they had just moved from Asia. Mm-hmm. They have nobody here. Literally the week they came, all of a sudden now they're faced with a son or a daughter that's diagnosed with this really bad disorder. It's not sickle cell, but it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got all their support system thousands of miles away.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, what that means is that we, the physician staff, the nurses, we have to be partners in this care. This is a partnership. We have to become the cheerleaders for that patient, for that family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember I talked about the puzzle. I said that education is one cornerstone of that puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't ask me what the other three corners of the puzzle are.
Okay, let's hear it.
You know, one, partnership. All right. We have to be willing, you know, it's that commitment to care. So we have to form that partnership with the patient and with the families. So one cornerstone is education. Another cornerstone is this partnership that we have to make. And it's literally an unwritten contract that you have to be willing to trust in us, and we have to be willing to trust in you. And the only way that can happen is if there is a partnership that forms. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like a business partnership in many ways.
You know, right.
So, you know, you're, I know you're, you've done well in the business world, but you think about the people that you've worked with, the clients you've served, other people you've worked with, it becomes a trust. And to build that connections and that partnership. So the second corner of the puzzle is partnership. We have to be willing to form that partnership. The third corner of that puzzle is honesty. And the honesty in many ways comes from us, the physicians and staff, because we have to be honest with the patient, the families, what we think. And as much as you as a parent want an optimism bias.
Right.
You know, we all want that optimism bias.
Right.
We have to be willing to have that honest conversation with you, Janita, Lisa, whomever, and just say, all right, here's what we actually think. But the only way we can actually have that honest conversation is if we've already entered into that partnership with you, and that we've already established that trust back and forth between the two parties.
Yes.
And that we've already started educating you for what you need to know. But you've also, that first corner about education, a lot of times when we meet with families, they're educating us.
Okay. Right.
And I've learned so much from patients, from families, just by listening to them. You know, like, oh, geez, I never even thought of that. Okay.
Yeah.
So I feel that for our team, the four corners are you've now heard three of them. I'll tell you the fourth in a second. So the first corner is education. It's a two-way street for education. The second corner is partnership and that trust. The third one is honesty. We need to be honest with you. We tend to have that optimism bias, but we also need to be honest. The fourth one is the one that every parent wants, every child wants, is to know that the team that's involved in their care truly cares about the care they're giving their son and daughter. And that literally has to be the backbone of this puzzle, is that, and it's not just from the physicians, it's from the nurses, the nurse practitioners, the social workers, the pharmacists that may interact with them, the environmental service person. You know, at the University of Michigan, we had a environmental service lady. Her name was Lisa. She's no longer on our floor, and I was devastated when she left. If Lisa listens to this podcast, I love Lisa dearly. Just so you can picture Lisa, she's in her 60s. She's African-American also. I don't think she had a college degree, but in many ways, she was the backbone of not just keeping the rooms clean, the floor clean, and all things like that, but she would just go in and just sit down while she was cleaning the room sometimes and just talk to the families and listen. And I learned more from Lisa about the patient's care. She would come out and say, Dr. Yannick, can I just talk to you about, you know, so-and-so, Jimmy Smith, Susie Smith, whomever. And I just want to tell you my thoughts and get your take. And I'm thinking, you know, this is from our environmental service person. But what she was doing was she was making that commitment to care. She was investing herself. And she was showing that she cared about the care that she was giving.
Mm-hmm.
I want the whole world to be full of Lisas.
Yes.
You know, years ago, 100 years ago, almost to be exact, in the 1920s, a famous British, or not British, famous American neurologist, he was working in Boston. His name was Francis Peabody. And I'm going to paraphrase something he said, and I hope it resonates with everybody listening to this. He actually made a comment one time in a journal, and he said, we're all in this, and this is not the exact quote, but it's close. We're all in this constant pursuit to find health and happiness in our own lives. Each of us are. But the real secret to finding health and happiness is to make joyful connections every day of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what it's all about, Janita, Lisa. It's to make a joyful connection. So I go into every day figuring out how many joyful connections can I make today?
Yeah. I mean, but even when you describe that, your interaction with Lisa, shout out to Lisa, whoever she may be and wherever she is, it brings me back to that circle, particularly that gratitude circle, because the fact that you took the moment, a moment, to listen to Lisa when she's like, Dr. Yana, can I share something with you? The fact that she knew that she could come up to you and share her thoughts, and that you weren't above her, you didn't put yourself above her, you took the time to listen to her, that speaks volumes. And that's another thing that doesn't happen, right? People are like, oh, I'm the clinical director. You don't do this, obviously, but I'm the clinical director, so I'm all knowing. And who this person from housekeeping, what could they possibly tell me? They're pulling trash. But that's not the case. And you were able to tap into her knowledge. We call it funds of knowledge in research. There's a researcher named Mull that talks about this. And you tapped into her funds of knowledge, and she felt comfortable, right, coming to you, and you were able to take that information and put it into consideration and for the patient care. And that's remarkable.
We had a situation several years ago where we had a patient that we had to make some difficult decisions. And if you're listening to this podcast, it was not about sickle cell. It was a child who had leukemia. And as we sat, you know, you said, all right, Mr. and Mrs. Smith again. let's meet at 1 o'clock. We just need to sit down and talk. The family knew, kind of got the gestalt of what we were going to be talking about. They asked if Lisa could join. You know, how often do you want housekeeping to be part of?
I love that. I absolutely love that.
You know, and I said, by all means. I also feel strongly with this, Janita, is that one of the things I've learned that people put a lot of faith and trust in religion.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes time for difficult decisions, I actually oftentimes will recommend that we bring a pastor in, a priest in, a bishop in,
yes,
a reverend in, because there's such a bond that our families have with, you know, their church, their minister, that, you know, when you're trying to establish that trust, the families listen to their minister many times. We had a patient, and I'll use his first name, the family. I gave a talk not too long ago, and the family allowed me to use his name. His name was Stephen. And Stephen, again, did not have sickle cell. He had leukemia. He was going through a bone marrow transplant, and it was just a difficult road. And at one point, I asked Stephen, I said, how do you do it? And he looked at me, and he said, faith over fear. Truly,
faith over fear. I love that.
And I think we as physicians, as nurses, have to recognize that many families put faith above all else, you know, and that we have to realize that this partnership, you know, that second corner of the puzzle, the partnership sometimes isn't just with the parents and the families and the patients. It's with their minister. It's with their priest, with their reverend, with their bishop,
mm-hmm,
because that's who these families put their faith and trust in. So we have to be willing to reach out to them. So it wasn't that long ago, Janita, that we had one of these intense discussions. And I asked the family, I said, do you mind if we bring in your minister to the discussion? And they were overwhelmed. I also don't have, you know, when I first started my career, I've been doing transplant for 30 years now. And in the early 1990s, religion was kind of a taboo topic. But you know what? For those of you that are listening who have a deep faith, it's always evident to us during the transplant process, your faith. And it may be, you know, it may be open that there's a cross on the wall that you put there, or rosaries in your hand, or a Bible in the room. But usually it's just by how parents talk and patients talk. I've now learned to embrace that in families. And it's not uncommon for us to actually pray with families.
Oh, wow.
For us to say the Lord's Prayer. You know, we had a family who not too long ago, they were Islamic, and they brought their imam in, and I just said, I'd love you to lead us in prayer. And, you know, it's not only important for that patient. It's not only important for that family. It's important for us, mm-hmm. the medical team, mm-hmm. to recognize that that imam, that minister, that priest, is vital to this person's whole being. And to be able to have that person come in and lead everybody in prayer, it's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, it is.
So as I've gone by in my career, you know, initially bringing up religion, as I said, was taboo. Now I've come a full 180.
I love that. Wow.
I've come a full 180. You know, and somebody commented the other day, said, "Dr. Hank, you know, that's kind of gutsy. You walk out of a room and say, you know, may God bless you." And I said, "No, it wasn't." Because, and obviously, I, by the way, in case you're listening to this podcast, I don't do that with everybody. I have to get that sense, that feeling, that knowledge that they have, that faith.
Right.
Meaning I don't impart my, and I certainly don't impart my faith on other people.
Right.
But if I see that a family, a patient, a husband, a wife has that faith, then I have no qualms, you know.
And it sounds like you ask for permission, like you're asking them, is it okay if I pray with you? Is it okay if I bring the minister in? So you're not just coming in saying, yes, let's pray. You're asking for their permission. And that makes a difference too. Dr. Yannick, what's the percentage of sickle cell patients who come in of the patients who receive transplant, what percentage are sickle cell patients?
That's a great question. Right now at the University of Michigan, we do roughly 50 bone marrow transplants a year on children and young adults, children, teenagers, and young adults. Okay. Out of those 50, I would say 5 to 6 a year are patients with sickle cell disease.
Oh, wow. Right?
At our own center now, we've done between 40 and 50 bone marrow transplants for children and teenagers and young adults with sickle cell. And to be honest with you, everyone has left a mark on my heart and my soul, because they've all just been such incredible patients and families.
Wow. So that's not that many.
No, it really isn't. And we're a fairly large center. So again, for those of you listening, we're doing maybe 5 to 6 a year out of a total of 50 a year. And in terms of where the field is going, I can think of two ways, Janita and Lisa. One, previously, transplant was reserved for children with sickle cell that had really severe phenotypes, in terms of a lot of really severe clinical manifestations. And it oftentimes took until they were teenagers or young adults to really say, you know what, this patient needs a transplant. The problem with that is the transplant gets tougher and tougher the older you are. Just because your body just has been beaten up more and more with the sickle cell, whether it's your blood vessels in the heart, the lungs, the brain, the liver, the kidneys, whether it's iron being stored and deposited in the liver or the heart. There's a lot of downstream stuff that happens, you know, as you get older, that just makes transplant more difficult. And thus, as I look at bone marrow transplant for children with sickle cell, I think in many, and this is just not for me, but I think if you ask any physician who deals, Dr. Campbell and other people who deal with patients with sickle cell, to be honest with you, the younger you are, the many ways, the better the transplant, the less toxicity you have with the transplant, the better the outcomes overall. So I think the field is starting to recognize now that the age for who should be transplanted needs to start coming down.
Mm-hmm.
A couple things have happened in the transplant world for children with sickle cell. One, historically, over the last 10 to 20 years, children with sickle cell have been considered for transplant if they had a brother or sister who was a match, okay, a sibling donor.
Yep.
But any one sibling has a 1 in 4 chance of matching the brother or sister, okay? So many of us have a family that don't have a sibling who matches, you know, the tissue typing genes that match. So that meant that we'd have to go to the unrelated donor registry, the National Marrow Donor Registry. It's called the NMDP registry. Using an alternative donor through the bone marrow registry for somebody with sickle cell, it ratchets up the intensity of the transplant. It ratchets up how much we have to suppress that patient's immune system to get that bone marrow to take. It just ratchets up all of the complexities of the transplant, the risk of graft versus host disease that we can talk about in a second, what that even means. But it ratchets everything up when you have to go through the National Marrow Donor Program using somebody that's not related to you in particular.
Right.
What's actually happened in transplant over the last 10 years in particular is the advent of what's now called haploidentical transplants. And this has revolutionized transplant for children with sickle cell. It's the ability to use a half match. And here's what I mean by half match, is that I myself, half of my genes come from my mom, half of my genes come from my dad.
Right.
So my mother is a half match or a haplo match. My father is a half match or a haplo match. A pretty incredible team, and I'll give credit where credit is due, has been spearheaded by the team at Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore. They were such big proponents of this haplo half match transplant idea and how to do it. And for years, people were like, oh, I don't know how they do this. How can you do a half match transplant? And then right. More and more centers started doing it. We said, dang, we can do this. you have to change the transplant, how the transplant is done, in order for you to get a half match in, because historically you want a full match donor to do it. So when you do a half match transplant, and it's probably a little more getting into the weeds than for this podcast, how we do it. But it can work.
Mm-hmm.
And it can work well. And having the ability to do haploidentical transplants for children with sickle cell has just opened up whole new avenues. And it's just made the field brighter
yeah.
in terms of the possibilities now. Because virtually everybody has a mother, a father, and even a sister or brother who may be a half match.
Yeah.
Obviously, that means that the mother, father, or sister, brother can't have sickle cell himself.
Mm-hmm.
Your donor is not going to be somebody who has sickle cell. But in many cases, the mother or father has sickle cell trait.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. So now we'll be taking a child with the transplant from a full sickle cell down to sickle cell trait. And you know what? That works.
Yeah.
For these patients, it's a new life. And as we talked about, there's still hurdles to cross and jump over and mountains to climb as time goes by. But boy, the advent of haploidentical transplants, it's just been not even a new sunrise. It's been a whole new sun altogether.
Yeah. I was going to ask you how, because I noticed just because of family and friends who I know that people were moving towards the half match. And I'm like, wow, I wondered how that happened. I also noticed that with the half, and so wait, let me back up. You answered one of my questions because I wanted to know if it could be a mom or a dad, but it sounds like it could be a mom, a dad, or a sibling who could do the half transplant. My other question is with the, I know Kennedy talked about when she did her treatment, she did a number of days of chemo, and then she had to do a day of radiation. And so I'm just curious to know about that, about the radiation. Like, what Is that just, is that better to suppress the system, or why is that done?
You know, it's not done in every case with radiation. There had been something unique to her case that we didn't, and it would just be typically one dose.
Okay.
Sometimes the radiation will give multiple days. In this case, it would have been one dose. And the trick with doing half-match transplants is this, is that we have to immune suppress the patient receiving the half-match incredibly well, meaning even more deeply than we have to with our other transplants per se.
Oh, okay.
But it's going to be a two-way street here in a second. But the first way, the first road down, the first street is with, let's say, Sophia, we're getting a half match, a haplotransplant. Now, we have to really, because the cells going in are only half matched to her body,
mm-hmm.
we would have to suppress Sophia's immune system tremendously to get that to take. Okay.
Okay.
But there's a catch to this. It's a two-way street. The immune system from the donor, as it starts growing, is going to start waking up and recognizing that, hey, what am I doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, this is not the body I'm supposed to be in. This is a body that's only half matched to mine. So what we do to get these haplo-identical transplants to take is we immune suppress the graft itself.
Okay.
And how we do that is as that, it's, I almost need to have a whiteboard and draw it out for you. People always say I can't talk without drawing. But so next podcast, I'll have a whiteboard.
Right. We'll get you a whiteboard. We'll do it on Zoom so you can use the whiteboard feature.
Exactly. And the way, what happens, Junita, is that you put the stem cells in, let's say we call it day zero. Day zero is the day that the stem cells go in. Okay.
Yep.
And then literally the second you put that stem cells in, the stem cells themselves will take about a week or so, 2 weeks to 3 weeks to start growing. But the rest of the immune system from that donor immediately go in and saying, what the heck am I doing here? This is not my body. So they start reacting already, causing this reaction called graft versus host disease. And I'll give everybody an explanation of what graft versus host disease is in about 2 minutes. But they start getting this reaction of the donor cells against the body. So literally 3 days after the new cells go in, we hit that patient again with chemo.
Oh.
Think about that. That 3 days after, 3 days after and 4 days after, on two consecutive days after a half-match transplant, we actually give a heavy-duty dose of chemotherapy right back to that patient. Now, not to target the patient's immune system, but to target the donor's immune system.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
And it works. But the stem cells themselves haven't really taken hold in the bone marrow to start growing. So the chemo misses the stem cells. So the stem cells then just keep growing.
Wow. Okay. So wait, before you talk about GVHD, and my listeners so far, they know what it is because we've been talking about it all season. What are the reproductive risks? Are they the same risks or same out? Not every outcome is the same, but are the reproductive health issues similar in half match as it is with full match?
They are. I actually feel, Junita, that the reproductive risks in many ways depend on the age at the time of transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With a half match transplant, I can't sugarcoat it. It's heavy duty chemo. It's heavy duty medication to suppress the immune system of both the recipient and the donor. So yes, it can affect the reproductive system downstream. Really, the secret to success, in my mind, is get the transplant done earlier. Now, by the way, as a parent listening to this, does that mean your child has to be transplanted at age 1 or 2? No. But just the cutoff seems to be that we're seeing is get the transplant done before 13, 14, 15. Okay?
Yeah.
And even
with that, there's no guarantee, right? Because, look at Sophia. But yeah, I mean, you said earlier that most doctors would agree that the earlier, the better. And that seems to be true.
Right.
And not only for the reproductive health, but also, now we're going to segue to graft versus host disease.
Next time on Waiting is the Hardest,
we wrap up our riveting conversation with Dr. Greg Yannick.
Tell us what you thought about the episode. Follow us on social media by searching Waiting is the Hardest podcast. And you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook.
This podcast is about the blessings and breakthroughs that result from waiting. Share your story of waiting at waitingisthehardestpodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.